So Ever, I could be my own one's one.
What did you make?
I made some chocolate cookies. I followed through. I said I would make something. I'm in Iowa. They're chocolate cookie, and then the like fudge chips, like a caramel chip.
Wow, that's good.
So I have time to go grab a cup. So we don't have to
I think someone here.
Mm.
We have
coffee. Oh, we're cups.
But no high half cups. We have plastic cups, not.
I'll grab one from the other way.
He's here, so I'm just going to say we're going to start. Time is 4:37. We're calling a meeting to order. First up it was going to be Dale because. It is my pleasure to congratulate him on being elected as chair of the CJC for next year.
Okay.
So he will be taking over my seat. I have will be taking over as UA chair and his gauge successor. I will still be here too.
Good.
And yes, I'm also very pleased to pass along congratulations to Dale. Dale, we're just congratulating you on being elected.
Thank you.
So I was going to say I have received work administration to pass along congratulations from the administration as well.
Oh.
Actually, I was writing emails before this. So first off, that moves into our minutes. We have April 25th and May 2nd on the agenda for approval. Those are the last paper, two formal items for action. So I'm going to ask if anyone has a chance to read through them. Any amendments or questions? Michelle stepped out. Michelle had asked at our last meeting to go back and check. She had raised some concerns about the JA reappointment language, which I'll be thinking about. She had concerns she took into account. But there was the April 18th meeting. We never had a formal quorum, so the minutes in essence reflect that. And therefore, we just wanted to note that as a that's why I did an addition. But the April 25th minutes were tabled. So we have the April 25th and May 2nd minutes on the agenda. Are there any comments, questions, concerns, or amendments for either of those sets of minutes?
I just received a couple from Michelle.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Just, read them off. I was trying to say we should table them, but considering that we're at the very end of the year, I think this is where they can make it out.
Okay. So for the April 25th approval of the minutes, from there, I didn't include asking complainants and respondents for feedback, so okay. She asked for that.
And the April 25th minutes.
Yeah.
Do you know where that's going to be inserted?
Oh no, I meant for the May 2nd minutes, where section 2, approval of minutes.
Ah, so we're adding language to the effect of?
Concerns about asking.
Complaints and respondents?
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Is that it?
And then on the next page, on point 8, instead of as they would be evaluating the AJA, not the JA, she noted that concern about this section was also shared.
Concern about the section because we're adding up about this section.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Yeah.
Okay. So I move the motion. Is there move the amendments? Is there any second to that?
Second.
Any dissent? Any dissent to inserting them? Fantastic. They're inserted. Okay, so that brings us back to full discussion on the minutes. We have April 25th and May 2nd on our open for discussion. Are there any comments or questions or motions for either of those minutes?
To approve.
So this move to approve. I'm going to interpret as both. Just because it's the last meeting and everyone's following along. Any dissent? Hearing none. For old time's sake, let's have a formal vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, please raise your hand or placard. All opposed. One out of the chair will be affirmative. I vote 6-0-0. The minutes are approved. That just reminded me of an SNL skit. And that brings us to our first item of business, which is our primary item for today, which is a working discussion, update, preliminary report, recess. I know we talked about the work group still in the process of putting together into a final report, but it was our goal to hit, if you have something by the last meeting, I think we met that. So if you have the floor.
Yes, I don't have written and so a bunch of us who are on the committee are here, which is great. And so I'll start it off. I think the committee, I think we did our job well and that we hit the goals for the committee. In terms of the process, I feel like the working group did everything we tried, you know, that we had as a goal, we really at least attempted to make as broad a discussion, to create as broad a discussion as we could. We had a lot of information going out to people. We had more participation in terms of actual people showing up to the public forums when there was information gathering, as opposed to the putting out, you know, proposals, drafted proposals. But we had people from the community come to every single meeting, and even if we had small groups, I think it was really effective in terms of getting the committee to kind of open up and see things from a public perspective, as opposed to always talking only to each other. Thanks to, you know, just really great participation by all the committee members, all the working group members, we have a nice set of written materials now, which I'm looking at, but I don't have anything to project or anything. And I think just the description of some of the places where we ended up with proposals, I think will be helpful to give you a sense of it. But just continue on process. So we have preliminary proposals that we've drafted based on these public forums, based on the discussions among ourselves and different drafts of things. And what we're going to do in order to draft a report that we think is a really good report is we decided not to try to get a written report in that wasn't complete just in order to do it like now. Particularly given that the presidential task force put in a preliminary report and their final report is going to be done at the end of this month, we thought that was a realistic kind of a timeline to use. And it was consistent with, you know, everybody's recognition that people need a little more time to put reports together. So with that in mind, at the last meeting we had on the third?
Last Friday. Last Thursday. Which would have been the third.
So at our meeting on May 3rd of the working group, we decided that within the next few weeks, we are going to put together a draft report. We're going to circulate it among the working group members and then formally give it to the CJC for its consideration next semester. And we also decided that the faculty and staff on the committee, and that would be me and Scott. Scott's last name, I just lost it.
Grant.
And Suman's staff, that we decided we should take on the heaviest lifting in terms of the writing, just to give the students a break, given that people were going off to do summer jobs and various things. But we're lucky enough that a lot of students are on campus, right? So Carlton, you're here. Victoria?
I'll be here.
Oh, that's right. You're
in the
bar.
Yeah.
Give me a break from the bar.
Yeah.
Right? And Aaron is also here working at the remote.
Yes.
Yeah.
The time. I'll
be in New York City, but I'm going to simple Zoom call away.
Right. So, and I don't know if Travis is here anymore.
He's graduating.
He's graduating.
So he will hopefully be here at least for commencement.
Right, but I will see that and I'll check on. So it'll be really pretty easy for us to, for the faculty and staff on the committee, kind of get something in place, circulate it to everybody, and we've worked really well together as a group, as a working group, so I think that we'll really have a nice package, you know, to report to give to CJC. So let me just highlight some things, and other people can just jump in terms of what I think some of the sort of substantive accomplishments were. One of the issues that was, I'll start at the beginning of the code. Our work kind of divided into considering amendments to the code as the code itself. And then as we had our working group discussions and public forums, it became apparent that there were concerns people had that were not directly related to the code, but were related to some issues of justice and transparency. And so I'll start with so we came up with recommendations in both areas, but I'll start with the code and actually start with the very beginning. So one of the suggestions was to work on the statement of principles and policies, Title I of the code. And to have more of a full statement about some of the principles that that could express some of the positive principles and values that underline or be part of the community here. And so one of our recommendations was to put in, bring in the Cornell motto, the one of I found an institution, you know, where any person can find instruction and study. And to say that this actually proclaims a community that affirms and defends diversity and inclusion. And one of the things that's interesting about this, and this is a broader point that I want to make, is that we're seeing a significant amount of convergence between the kinds of proposals we came up with and the proposals from the subcommittee on campus climate. Actually, I always forget what it's called. Regulation of speech and harassment. It's part of the campus climate.
On campus climate.
So the subcommittee came up with its preliminary proposals, and we looked at those in our last meeting. And it's a real convergence and overlap between what they're recommending and what we're recommending, which we took to be a positive kind of a result. And they also recommended that that Title I be enhanced with more sort of positive aspects of the kind of principles and values. The preliminary report from that subcommittee and the other ones from the Presidential Task Force are online, so people haven't seen it, it's easy to find. So we're going to, in our drafting of the proposals we came up with, we're also going to refer to the subcommittee from that Presidential Task Force and see if there are things that they came up with that we also want to include. And there may be some things that subcommittee suggests that we don't want to include, but I know in looking at the principles at Title I aspect that you know, I think we're in agreement that subcommittee came up with some very good ideas for principles. I'm being accurate about that.
Right? They had ours and public.
Right, they had a little bit more. So I think that's really an interesting aspect of what happened, because we were really working on parallel lines and there's a real convergence in the concerns that everybody's hearing and the recommendation. One of the major aspects that we were looking at had to do with, I'll just go to that and then I'll pick up some of the other ones, clarifying the language on harassment in the code. I don't actually have the titles in front of me. I'm looking at our Google Docs, and if somebody has that title.
Friends clarifying or clarification, the title?
Yeah. No, I mean, I have it in front of me. I just don't have the title of the
code. Oh, the doc, let me think of
the code.
Article. You mean the title of our Google Doc?
No, the title of the code.
Oh, it's
Title 3. Title 3.
It's in Title 3, Article. I think it's 3D.
Okay. 20. Yeah, we have it separated out, so it's in Title 3. Yeah. The recommendations that we've come up with, and we're going to be tweaking them, but the overall approach is to clarify the definitions of harassment as well as the specific type of harassment in terms of discriminatory hostile environment harassment in ways that incorporate a lot of the language from policy 6.4. So rather than people being confused about are the definitions different in one than the other, in some ways there are differences, but in other ways there's some real correspondence. And so we're recommending incorporating a lot of the 6.4 language into the code. And we think that clarifies it. That's particularly on hostile environment, but also on generally the idea of harassment beyond sexual harassment or beyond anybody's particular group identity. We have some language to add about harassment generally. And then we have discriminatory hostile environment harassment that identifies the various group membership or identity that should be protected specifically, and that defines hostile environment harassment in terms of the well-known unwelcomeness and severe or pervasive standard that's used in law as well as in 6.4. Let's see. Oh, right. And we also expanded the, we recommend expanding the provisions about stalking because that was so general. Like, what stalking was following anybody?
Right now, it's complemented with harassment.
Right. So to separate out stalking and to give it a meaning that is more consistent with New York law, as well as with some of the model codes that we've seen on that online. So for example, it would be to stalk another person, we recommend it be to stalk another person by one, intentionally engaging in a course of conduct directed at a specific person, and two, that would cause a reasonable person to feel threatened or frightened. And then we have another line in there about defining stalking as a course of conduct, or excuse me, defining a course of conduct, it defines the pattern of actions composed of more than one act over a period of time, however short, evidencing a continuity of conduct. So we have to, you know, play with some of this language, but the idea is to be more specific about that, the meaning and the definitions. Another aspect of what we're recommending that I think is very important is that we're recommending that CJC, along with other relevant Cornell offices, create guidance along the lines of the kinds of things that OCR has done. And I guess you can call something about EEOC, but both agencies have done guidances that are really helpful that expand out the meaning of some of the terminology in statutory provisions, and here would be the code provisions and give examples. And we thought that that would be helpful to people who want to know more about what this means. One of the things we're going to discuss more, we discussed this at our last meeting, is the subcommittee from the Presidential Task Force has a specific recommendation to bring in the term academic freedom with regard to distinguishing between prohibited speech or conduct and protected academic freedom. We don't have that specifically listed in our recommendations so far, but we had a good discussion on the ways in which classroom activity particularly needs to be protected. And so we agreed to revisit that question and see whether we want to recommend adding something specific about academic freedom in regard to harassment, where to do it so that it does the work we want, but not more than the work. I think that's what I've got to say about this provision. This was the one, of course, that took the most time, because it was more of the actual amendments. Does anybody want to add anything who was in the working group on this?
I just briefly add, there's a bunch of other outside of the code provisions that are being examined, or outside of non-code provisions that are being examined. There's some other small things where they look at in terms of just that you're looking at how to examine the jurisdiction. A lot of it is actually...
Oh, no, I was going to get to those. I'm on this provision.
Oh,
sorry,
absolutely.
I don't mean to cut you off.
No,
actually, I guess I do need to cut you off.
No,
but, but I'm on this, because this was the most contentious, it took the most active discussion back and forth. I just wondered if anybody had anything on this particular provision.
I have Michelle Spears, that's why I'm on this report.
Yeah, so just with that, the stuff about the stalking,
mm-hmm.
The hearing boards have, because the clear and convincing is so high to meet,
mm-hmm.
when you add that intentionality element, that's going to be a really hard element to prove, because you have to do it to that high of a standard and prove intentionality. So if there's a need to want to expand the definition, I would maybe think about that language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can I just mention that we talked about that?
Yeah.
And one of the things that we didn't do was to bring in an idea of specific intent. That is, was this intended to have a certain effect of making somebody feel threatened or frightened, as opposed to was the course of conduct itself intentional, kind of a general intent?
I would say that's still a good challenge. Right here,
or
to make that distinction based on some of the public
precedents
in there, the
intentional
standard, the parts of the code
that
have that rarely,
if
ever get met.
But what?
Rarely, if ever get met.
Mm-hmm.
If we had a.
And are you talking about sort of
the
general intent idea as opposed to a specific intent?
Yeah, they're hard to make. make it. And so if we had a clearing, if we had a lower standard of proof, I could say that that would be the balance of that. But if this is supposed to be protective mechanism for our Kansas community, that would be the suggestion I would leave on that piece.
Okay. That's
easy to hear. The hearing board decisions for what they are. A, I think this is also why I think the guidance document is so important. But B, it's also that ensuring that the hearing boards, and make sure we get a discussion with this president of the task force, ensuring that the hearing boards are aware prior decisions have in essence, a persuasive precedential effect, not a binding precedential effect, and that, in essence, it's not one hearing board made it some 20 years ago that will bind all future ones. It is their treated as the sister court that made it, and that's not as no legal term, it's persuasive, not binding. And I know there's been some confusion over that. That's the way this committee has always seen it. Speaking of looking at UA records, that's the way we've always seen it. And speaking with the task force, sprint, they have received some information that may not be the case. And I think a guidance document will go a long way towards ameliorating that to ensure that precedents, again, such as that, are not being used to handcuff new evolutions and new modifications of the code.
I can actually clarify that because I do take them as binding. I think that if the hearing board makes a decision on how the code needs to be interpreted, unless I think it's appealed, that's how my office has to interpret it. So I think that's for that clarification. So because the hearing board is a check on the JA, so I'm less likely to deal with the questions where 20 years ago I can say that we think this needs to be overturned. But any decision in the past couple of years, I take it as mine.
I think it's a larger discussion of how we want to interpret it because you can balance that.
Yeah, and I think this is the sort of discussion too. I mean, I'm happy to get that we're getting input. And actually, Kathy Zahner was there at the last public forum that we had. It was really helpful to have her there in terms of asking like how you think this should be, enforced. But I think this is also the kind of discussion that we anticipate occurring at the CJC on this report present. Yeah.
How would that be said? But how would that like be put into law whether or not a hearing board precedents are binding versus persuasive?
In terms of would you, it's would be language wise,
would that be ever put into the code?
Yes and no. Right now, the code, and I've probably had Lucas read it recently, as others. In essence, it says that prior they have a precedential value, they're publicly available. They can be used. The agencies will always bring them up if they can find one. I don't imagine. That being said, there's a certain point where, in terms of trying to balance that, and the hearing board decided a couple of years ago, it's a recent hearing board, in essence, is a reason it likely would want to stand. Whereas 20 years ago, it's balance. I think it's Jill's point as well. It's a balancing act between you don't want the JA to constantly be relitigated until I get a favorable precedent, but you also don't want precedents that are too old to bind hearing boards, especially as you move, again, for rewriting language, in theory, you don't want, if we're going to edit the code, conceivably that's us saying what we're trying to move around to the precedent. So trying to take a balance, I think there's a way to do that language-wise. I think it's a longer discussion, which I'm sure you and I will have a very long discussion about next year. And I'm sure anyone else, I'd have to have it now, but the timing is dangerous.
I'm sure this will come up more in the fall once we get the actual language in front of us. But just, I think part of the process of protecting our campus climate is also affording, the review process protections to accused. I wouldn't completely dismiss the idea of, a higher intentionality requirement. I think there's pros to that as well as cons for administrability. But I'm sure we'll get more into that in the fall.
We did discuss that issue of the specific intent to cause, somebody to be fearful or feel threatened was quite a high standard. And actually, New York State doesn't use it. But one could argue they should, but they don't. So we thought the general intent was appropriate. Yeah. Yeah, but it's useful to get the feedback. And I'm sure that, when we discuss it further, perhaps you could give some examples of other parts of the code or a problem. Yeah.
After all, some speakers list, I think crazier
also. Okay, great. So in terms of other provisions, and this is, again, some of these areas we overlapped or converged directly with some of the recommendations that came out of the subcommittee, as well as some things that are being considered more broadly. And one of them is to bring the brief organizations under the code that our recommendations include considering fraternities and sororities. university registered organizations covered by the campus code of conduct. We thought that seemed pretty clear. And that's something that comes out of the subcommittee as well. The scope of jurisdiction was something else that we took a look at, and our recommendations.
Coffee with no cups.
So one of the things that we recommended was that the CJC develop guidance about what constitutes a serious violation that's worthy of extending jurisdiction beyond campus for application of the code, because at this point the code includes financial language about the judicial administrator after having the approval of the president through the dean of students or the provost, or dean of students for student conduct, provost for faculty conduct, vice president for human resources for staff conduct, that if conduct is a serious violation of the code, that in that instance, the code could go more broadly off campus. And so we think that the CJC should look at that more closely to say, can there be greater guidance about what that serious violation might actually mean? We're also recommending that the CJC clarify the scope of jurisdiction of the code with regards to covering electronic communications sent from or received on campus or using Cornell servers. And recommend that the CJC consider expanding the jurisdiction of the code in relation to code violations concerning electronic communications. I guess more clear in perhaps considering expanding this. And then in terms of the language that I just read about, whether it's the president or the president's representative be involved in the decision to expand jurisdiction, we recommend that the CJC consider whether that approval is appropriate or necessary, I guess, in all cases. So that's those are proposals that we're putting out in that area.
Any comments or questions on those proposals?
I'm just curious about the off-campus jurisdiction. That last kind of this, they thought to be more expansive, or what? I mean, what were kind of the most of the conversation.
Yeah, and other people can jump in, but I think the concern was that, you know, there are off-campus incidences, and including, you know, issues of assault, racist assaults, and, you know, racist harassment that are off-campus but very close to campus, and some of this issue of just how broad should the code, when it includes people in the community, who would be under the code if these incidences occurred on campus, should the code just stop at the borders of the campus? And the provisions here say, no, the code doesn't stop at the borders of the campus. If it's a serious violation, if there's approval, right, of the president or the president's designee. And so my interpretation of what we're talking about, and again, I'm just going to jump in, was that we were, I think, that the catalyst for us considering this was the reality of where things are happening with people in college campus. Captured.
Yeah, that was definitely the concern, is that things happen in college town that are clearly motivated between students, and that, like, happen between students at the university can't really intervene, and that's really disturbing. And I think that, like, might be in some cases more difficult to apply and extend the jurisdiction, but I think that in terms of students knowing that the university is going to protect them under all circumstances is really important, especially noting that events that happen in like fraternity like areas might not be considered under the code, but clearly that's a student organization that like affects other students. So I think that was a lot of the morale of doing that change.
I think related to Carlton, your point was also talking a little bit more about like what we, through what we've heard from the community, consider to be serious offenses that might warrant extending that jurisdiction as well.
Okay.
Sure.
That's what I consider serious, just as you guys are drafting language.
Mm-hmm.
So I always make requests for off-campus jurisdiction for drug sales, for any sort of physical altercation, anything that is hazing related, and anything that property damage over a massive amount. So if somebody were to take someone's jacket from a bar, I'm not going to request off-campus jurisdiction. And then other categories to be determined. So physical actions, drug sales, hazing, and others that are usually the big ones.
Mm-hmm. And how often have you asserted jurisdiction? This year?
A lot of our cases involve local respondents.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at like group misconduct, you're going to request off campus jurisdiction for everyone who was there.
Mm-hmm.
Especially a bit hazing cases.
Mm-hmm.
Faculty and staff, I don't believe that I request off campus jurisdiction for faculty.
Mm-hmm.
70 might be, it's probably 50 to 70 now that I think about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of it, in terms of the work that I've heard on the speakers list, is that it's just the clarity about, in part of what's there's transparency. Okay, if we're doing this frequently and it's being done, maybe we don't necessarily change the code. How do we ensure that people are aware that it's not that it's not certain sincere it's used once or twice a year, it's used routinely when needed?
Yeah,
that,
I agree.
That's the that guided factor and other ways to do it. Because the fact matters, if we didn't know this, John Doe or Jane Doe on the street or John student or whatever wouldn't have to. And then yes, for the code has a notice function as well. It is okay, transparency, I think, is something we're looking at. And a lot of the recommendations, even precedent for this, I think, where they're focused on the idea of, okay, how do we ensure everyone's on the same page and that people understand where we are and that discussion had at some point and then documented some ideas.
So this notion of extended jurisdiction, I mean, it looks like it has three dimensions to it. So one of them is university activities. So if it's a ball team going to another school, that jurisdiction follows the team because it's the second is what Michelle was describing, that those are events or violations determined. So some violations may have extended service, extended jurisdiction, and others would not. But it's the violation that determines it. The third is space, you know, which is, should College Town be part, you know, as a space or not? Looking at this, I'm suspicious. Suspicious. I suspect. I suspect that the violation-centered one is the most ambiguous in terms of potential violators. That it's better that the code follows a ball team or a chorus group or whatever. That I think they would intuit if they didn't know it. The extended jurisdiction off Cornell property, I think that's unambiguous once you state it. And perhaps it would be ingrained. It'd be odd, you know, people were determining their behavior. But, you know, they leave College Town a block and they're off or something. But at least it's unambiguous. I worry about the ambiguity, though, in a violation center, just as Matt said, or implied at least. You know, those covered by the code should know unambiguously when they're covered by the code. And that would be.
Thank you. I have Casey and Victoria.
So I have a question for Michelle and Risa, which maybe kind of parallels a little bit your question, Richard. So in the way that the working group is thinking about this expanded jurisdiction, is this more like what Michelle is saying? There's some categories like drugs, you know, physical assault that obviously we can't turn a blind eye to and say, like, oh, you have no ramifications if you just, you know, have this giant drug charge on your record of all your students. That would make sense. So is it kind of including that, kind of that sphere, that list of things that would fall into that? Or is it alternatively applying the code more broadly throughout, like Richard was saying, through like a bigger area where every single thing that's an issue at the code is just going to be also something that's considered? So I guess it's kind of like a portable
or something. Yes, yeah, you well, I think it's both. One is the series violation. What does that mean to the, that's the clarification aspect. And part of our recommendations in that area is that this clarification should be in the form of a guidance. Okay, yeah, like the way we're talking about the guidance to regard to harassment, to provide people with more information about what's the code mean rather than just packing the code full of more language. And so our recommendation includes that the guidance should recognize the seriousness of incidents against a person under Title III, Article III, Section 1, especially those involving bias, violence, and other acts which create a hostile environment for any person or group of people, which goes back to that point about, you know, what was the catalyst for concern here, and that the CJC should consider whether this guidance should be a separate document or should the guidance be made by the code itself. And then there's the scope issue. And I guess we really didn't talk about just how far off campus that would go, right? Because we're thinking more, I think our thinking was more in terms of what College Town is virtually part of campus. So we really didn't clarify that in terms of just how broadly. But the other breadth aspect goes more towards the electronic communications issue to say, you know, how that the CJC should clarify this code of jurisdiction over electronic communications, which deals with, you know, where you send it from campus, you receive it on campus, or if you use Cornell servers. And if you use Cornell servers, that could be, you know, quite extensive. And there's probably more consideration of exactly what that means and how far that would go. So
Richard, I have Victoria, Casey, and then you. So
yeah.
It's kind of related to Richard's point earlier. I think part of whether students are going to be on notice about whether the code sort of applies to them is sort of less, I think the mechanics of how the code actually applies to them is less important than how we sell the code to them. I think if we sell the code to students as, yes, technically this only applies within the boundaries of campus as defined in the code, but that this is sort of a statement of our values as a part of the Cornell community, student, staff, and otherwise, that people will be aware that the code should apply to them wherever they are, whatever they're doing, even if it doesn't practically or in the actual incident apply to them. So I think it's more about shifting people's thinking than drawing actual jurisdictional lines.
Thank you. Next is Casey.
So I think regarding extending more jurisdiction over electronic communication, I think generally education law has been averse to regulating communication that happens off campus and that is not in line with curricular outputs. So I think that there might be a hard, legal step to overcome unless you can prove that it would foreseeably cause a substantial material disruption. So I think just like looking at the state of education law, it would err to not allow substantial regulation like that of electronic communication.
Yeah, you're saying even if it uses Cornell servers.
I mean,
I'm actually very sympathetic to not expanding it too far, but I'm just, I don't know this area of the law.
I think that would depend. The cases that I read, it was a student like from home talking about school.
Mm-hmm.
So I think because it's Cornell property, I think that could be a separate question. But I think that itself might be hard to figure out too.
Yeah, I think
like what is going to use.
And I think the CJC should think about this very carefully because there are academic freedom issues, there are speech issues. And so I think the last thing we want to do, you know, and I think this lines up with what Victoria was saying, is have people feel like this is some kind of additional layer of of surveillance, monitoring, you know, chilling effects on people's speech. I think that's a very important issue. And so if we're going to recommend some sort of expansion to actually deal with problems of harassment, you know, of misconduct that fits into other parts of the code, probably dealing with it with a scalpel as opposed to the axe is a good thing to consider. Yeah.
Richard, you are excellent.
So, the university already can look at email.
Sanctuary's own system, correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know.
I don't want to encourage it.
Yeah, I don't want to tell people or whatever you want to do. But the second is that if you were thinking of extended jurisdiction in the physical sense, not the electronic one,
mm-hmm.
but you could think of extending jurisdiction to the density of residential housing for students, and you could have a metric for that.
Mm-hmm.
And that would get you to College Town, that would get you, you know, moving. You know, North Campus Way and so forth and so on. And that would give you, because it's basically, it's student to student, well, student to faculty or any members of the university community, it's their physical interaction and exchanges of thought that we want to consider here. And that would be a definition that would be not arbitrary.
You mean including off campus?
Yeah, including off campus. So, an off campus extended jurisdiction would be, you know, if you got 500 kids per square mile, it's College Town, it's 10,000. But you know, you could think about how to work that, and that gives you a real sense. Victoria, I don't want to disagree with you because I think we're in agreement on what the values should be, and I'd like them right up. Front this in the preamble to the code, and I think everybody covered the same way, no matter who they are. So I have an agreement with that. What I think about though is the specificity of this, of knowing when you're covered, has to do with rights. You know, it doesn't have to do with endorsing those values. Somebody who's prone to do this, and we know, unfortunately, there are people who are prone to do these things, you're not going to persuade them. You regulate them, basically. And to pretend you're trying to persuade them by having ambiguous jurisdiction.
I mean, I don't really think they think about the jurisdiction, though. Like, I don't think people decide, you know, I'm going to commit something here.
Oh, no.
That's not
it's,
I don't think regular people think like that. So.
I agree with that. It's just if they think about, you know, in this space, how am I regulated? This is actually an important issue.
Mm-hmm.
We're regulated in different ways, like in different spaces all the time. And we do this voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
And in all those ways, I like people to know when they're in a particular space that they're regulated in this way, even if we think they should be regulated everywhere in this way. It's just a matter of rights rather than disagreement with the values.
I mean,
at this point, the code just says elsewhere, conduct elsewhere. The title shall also apply to conduct elsewhere if the judicial administrator, with the approval of the president, et cetera, considers conduct to constitute a serious violation of the title, of this title. And then in that, the conduct poses a substantial threat to the university's mission or property or to the health or safety of university community members. So at this moment, it's very, very ambiguous. So I think some of the recommendations we're making actually will create greater clarity, and I guess one question is, in creating greater clarity, should it include, as Casey was saying, kind of a clarity in terms of the vertical nature of, you know, the importance, the seriousness of it, as well as the horizontal expansion, you know, so this might actually really be helpful in what you're talking about here. Yeah.
I'm curious to ask Michelle and Dale, just to briefly add, I think a lot of, actually, the brief earlier discussion about how do the hearing boards and our precedent work. It's Michelle's point, actually, to reconsider what I had said. the way the CDC has looked at a lot of things historically in terms of precedent has been in terms of, oh, it really was more of a fact-specific, I think the way Michelle described it, in terms of, oh, take for granted the Ms. McBride hearing, where the hearing board said this provision does not apply outside of a violation of public order. And this is to try and balance, I think, the code right now has these ambiguities in terms of elsewhere. Conceivably, a hearing board one day could say, oh, we send jurisdictions that happened in around the world, somewhere in Asia. I mean, just geographically, so far removed, the hearing board can say, no, this is not. I mean, so I think the balancing, and I think the guidance document, I think will have a lot of ability to fill in some of the ambiguity, not necessarily tinker with the direct code, to say, okay, here's where we are going, almost to try and ensure that there's transparency around the precedent, or even to have some sort of publicly transmitted that, okay, the hearing boards have said X, this is a binding precedent versus, oh, the hearing board, and I think distinction is facts with the versus, the provision of urban being struck down or limited, but I think that relates to this is one of the people where I haven't shelved it down.
Yeah, I know we have a lot of students of Los Angeles Asia says you guys are crafting language. We keep talking about students, but the code covers faculty and staff. And so when we talk about like 500 people, and now you're disproportionately impacting students instead of being equitable in the enforcement. So that's just one thing for y'all to consider. Is it the fun job of drafting, which hopefully someone's wearing their magician words.
I was going to kind of agree and say that mentioning population density doesn't really, while it might increase fairness, it's not really good for clarification because I don't think any of us know the population density of students at any place at any time when we're in this area.
Well, the university does.
The university does.
No,
but
there's I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, the point you were making was that we as, like, you know, people under the code should know when we're covered.
Oh,
and I don't think.
No. Once you know the population density, then you draw the line. That's the idea. So the line then becomes, you know, you are covered by the code if you're within this the space. No, they don't know that. Do you have your speaker's list or
you have
okay, right. So Michelle, I think that's exactly right about inequalities, except that the principle is members of the Cornell community, regardless of who they are, the probability of personal contact. So I would include in this density thing faculty. So if you make it, you know, large enough, then you get all of Cayuga Heights, you know, but it would be, so the principle would be neutral. The effect certainly would be, you know, that students, because they live in dorms and ghettos and stuff, then, you know, are going to be disproportionately covered.
Warrens.
There's another point. What do we say? Act communities. I agree with that. The criteria is neutral, but the effect has this inequality. But I think it's appropriate because we're regulating personal interaction.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just have to consider if you're looking at it just for this provision, but let's say we had a staff member who was then selling drugs while they were vacationing in Europe, right? Like, and people died as a result of that. We would request off-campus jurisdiction for that case. And so by your criteria, because it wasn't in that geographic bounds, that wouldn't be something that we could request. So I guess I'm if you're saying to, like, just limit to the harassment provision, I guess
But I'd be opposed to that. But if it's a staff member selling drugs to somebody who's not a member of the Cornell community in Europe, you know, why are we, that's not our business. I mean, perhaps that's a radical concept, but it's not our business. that's not persuasive to me.
I think that's what we disagree with. I think anyone who's associated with our university reports the values of staff, faculty, or student. We have an interest in that.
That's for the revision of the code. That's the revision we might address.
I think this is what we talked about in terms of the code holistically. That'll come up in the fall. I have Carl on speaker list. I will note that the discussion is starting a little circular, and that in essence, this is a much larger than we can discuss today. So I'm going to ask Carl if there's anything you want to add. Finally, about the last word, and we'll go back to Risa and keep moving along. Okay. Risa, you are.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this I think is all really useful. It also sort of gives us a sense of just how, let's say, rich the discussions will be next year when we have this. That, you know, this is a real jumping off point. Because the things people are raising, including the kinds of things that you were raising, which I never agreed to be able to raise, things like, you know, off-duty sort of conduct and whether that should be counted when we talk about jurisdiction. So, you know, these are not going to be easy discussions. We're trying to give you a sense of where we ended up. Let me mention on sanctions that our recommendations include, this is title, I guess this fits into Title III and to some extent Title IV. We recommend that the CJC create guidelines to help university hearing boards apply sanctions in cases of code violation. This is consistent with the sort of discussions we've had before. And we recommend that these guidelines impose greater sanctions on code violations in which there is one, an offense against a person, two, bias, or three, violence, as well as those which lead to hostile environment, either educational, residential, or work, hostile environment, threatening person, or even persons. So it's kind of a notion of an aggravating factor that could actually justify increasing sanctions. Again, this isn't uncontroversial. This is an area where I think there will be a lot of important discussions around what is an appropriate aggravating factor and what isn't.
Any questions
on
that?
Okay. We supported what seems to be generally supported across campus, including the subcommittee from the Presidential Task Force, of looking into encouraging and recommending that the CJC expand the use of alternative dispute resolution and restorative justice programs to resolve alleged violations of the campus code. And we note that using ADR and restorative justice could help move the code toward being genuinely educational rather than only punitive. And we recommend that the codes, that the CJC consider amending the code itself to provide options for expanding use of ADR and restorative justice programs. I think that's consistent with the kinds of things that Sheldon said a number of times in this in our discussions. That's a general recommendation. We're good? Everybody wants more transparency. And so, you know, the more we can do to, we recommend that the more we can do basically to have records that are already public be more accessible and increase transparency with regard to decisions from hearing boards and people's ability to get that information as well and other sorts of information, the better. I think, and that also moves to non-code changes. We have general recommendations that identify the kind of things we're talking about, including the need for ongoing transparency and reporting of information to communities, to the various communities about incidences which affect the campus climate, and that groups like CJC and adjudicatory bodies and the Cornell Police can, you know, should be involved in engaging those kinds of actions and provisions that increase transparency. We recommend greater comprehensive and ongoing education and training of faculty, teaching assistants, resident advisors, and students on issues about power, bias, and inequalities, including those that are based on race, gender, and disability. And that the this sort of education and training should include ways to address issues in the classroom, in residence halls, and in interpersonal interactions, and that kind of educational aspect of really addressing the issues. We recommend having the Cornell Bias Assessment Response Team provide more information to the public on bias-related incidents, including follow-ups about how many bias-related incidents have been resolved, and to create greater links between BART and the code so that they're not sort of freestanding aspects, but that there's the ability of
for example, people who want to go to the code and find out things to actually see that BART is part of the university in ways that can help. When you talk about those kind of gray areas, which sometimes you have incidents that don't rise to the level of an actual violation, that BART could be more helpful in that way. We also talk about recommending making governance bodies more diverse and people on there, which will increase the meaningful representation of different groups on those governance bodies. Recommend more support and financing for academic programs that address systemic inequalities, you know, including Latino studies, Asian American studies, Africana Studies Research Center, the American Indian Program, FGSS, et cetera. Again, to create some consistency between what we say in the code and what we actually support on campus. And I think that covers what we talked about.
Fantastic. It's a lot there. Is there any closing comments or concerns? Hearing none, I'll...
Can I just make
one
comment? I just want to say that as hard work as this was and how much we all put into this, that it was really incredibly rewarding to work with the working group. Everybody on there was just a joy to work with, and people were willing to really interact with each other on difficult issues in ways that I think really moved us forward. So I know for me it was not only meaningful, but I learned a lot from actually listening to other people, and not only the people in the working group, but those who came. So I know I really appreciated it.
You still, I always want to say, for most of us, going to thank everyone. As you say, the members of the working group and members of this committee were formally thanked by formal resolution at the UA yesterday. And the working group put a lot of time and effort, the whole committee has. And just to thank you for that. President Pollack is interested in your work. I've had conversations. I told her our working group and her task forces are really on the same page, which is, I think, excellent. It validates that both, in essence, have really gone out and done their job. Two supervisors came to the same conclusion. I think personally for me, the big takeaway is, in addition to the language, looking at harassment and the actual code language, I think a lot of it really comes down to the transparency and the guidance portion. I think a lot of the concerns that President Pollack has raised about our code, and a lot of it, the issues we've seen are not so much, and they are, because the code can only be improved itself, but a lot of it is understanding the code. I was always thinking of like a campus code of conduct for dummies kind of thing. So understand how the process works, how the precedent is, and how precedent plays in. Essence that some precedent should be seen as binding, some maybe less so, and to clearly define how that is operating and have a discussion about jurisdiction. I mean, to do that will be an undertaking because, in essence, ambiguity can be easy. In law school, you choose sometimes you leave ambiguity intentionally because you leave it to someone else to figure out at a later time. I think, though, that there are some areas where we can put down and put the guidance and put into a public facing document that's informative. Obviously, that'll be a long discussion. I will personally, it's something I look forward to having next year with the continuing members. Even if you aren't continuing, we hope to still have you here. Because, you know, the meetings are for the public. We generally have some more food. I would say the recordings are wonderful. And in terms of next steps, the report will come to the committee. The actionable items are likely the definitions to the amendments for harassment and stalking. Those ones I expect. The committee will likely sit down with the president's task force version, the working version, figure out what we like of each, create either a walk between or pick one. And then I expect we'll be able to take our working groups and we'll pull things with the task force. Approved the CJC, the UA. I imagine the president will likely sign off, assuming that we're on similar tack as her task forces are. And then we'll move forward. The other recommendations we'll have to work on a case by case basis because they're a little broader. But otherwise, that's really where we are. I think I saw Dale pay up.
I was just wondering, is this guidance document going to be purely just suggestions to create clarity in the community, or will there be anything essentially legally binding in the guidance document about how the hearing boards will have to interpret the code?
Yes, and that's a conversation that we've had. In terms of the committee has the full range of options in front of it. One of our code amendments, we're asking for more control over set of the hearing board procedures. So certain portions that are procedural certainly can, I already should, be put into those procedures. Other provisions, you may wish to have some analysis document that's more with staples of code, something that's just informative. I mean, there's certain things I think belong in certain places. For instance, the task force, one of the recommendations is to put a lot of things in the code. Speaking for really myself, I think that might be a mistake. To change the code is a high bar, intentionally, and I think rightly so. There are some things where, in terms of transparency and reporting, obviously the code should always say transparent report at PERMA. The actual method, if the web address changes, we shouldn't have to go amend the code to change it. There's some things where you need a little more flexibility. I think varying a sliding scale will give us that flexibility. Or even that means that something like how we handle precedent, I think, is important. That's maybe more important institutionalized. Because as I said, the committee has long looked at the way that, oh, it should be more persuasive. But then again, the hearing boards, when they do make a ruling in terms of scope clauses, that in theory should not be quite separate ways. It should be more in terms of, as Michelle interprets it, more as a hard and fast ruling. So to have that discussion and have some clarity, I think, is beneficial to everyone. Because it also provides a notice for the community and ensures that we're on the same page with the DA's office, we're on the same page with the president, and that's trying to keep everyone together.
Yeah, I think that question of what kind of weight or binding nature of guidance has is a really complex one. And if you think about like the EEOC, they have guidances and OCR, you know, the Office for Civil Rights, which enforces Title IX, they have guidances. And there's a certain lack of clarity generally for just how binding those can be. So like the EEOC, when they adopt a guidance, it could be through their rules and regulations, which is more formal in how it's adopted, or it could be within the agency itself. And courts will say, well, we're not bound by these, but we find them influential because they come from an expert agency. And you know, the Office for Civil Rights has guidances, and some of them really go through a public comment period. They're quite formal, and it's the agency saying, this is in fact how we will govern ourselves. Courts don't have to follow those, but it's the way the agency governs itself. So I think that, you know, it would be really useful next year to have a discussion about the model that we want to use to say, you know, what are the different models for something like a guidance and how the institution treats it for itself. But I don't think it's clear yet.
Right. My fear is just that we're going to put so much work into creating a really good guidance document that will help the campus community really understand the code, maybe for the first time ever. And I don't want students or faculty members or anyone else to then be potentially in front of a hearing board who then doesn't follow that guidance.
Yeah.
I mean, we've kind of put so much work trying to increase clarity.
Absolutely. That's a longer, I mean, it's a transition of how you put a clause in the code saying this is right. It's a long conversation. I think the reason we're briefing over now is, frankly, I think we're working with an excellent job. We have a tight timeline. Realistically, with our staffing hiccups, we didn't think it'd go in until February, and they really worked very hard, meaning almost weekly, sometimes both of them weekly to do this. It's been, I mean, really, I can't commend them enough. And I think to me, I think the guidance document keeps it, even thinking the precedent thing is really on my mind, because it's thinking of Michelle's point. I think the more I think about it, the more I think it's the right approach, but also noting that, okay, yes, it should be binding for at least a couple of years, but then over time, you know, 20 years, things change, the code is amended. To have some clarity on that, I think, is crucial. And I think that filters into a lot of the other elements, because in terms of even for how we communicate, again, is that the committee has long, my understanding has been more in terms of persuasive. If we're on different pages, it means we're communicating different things to different people, and that can be creating more confusion. But I think at the very least, to standardize and noting that hearing boards, to a certain point, they need flexibility, but also to ensure they have at least they're all getting certain information that they can take and utilize if they see fit. I believe it's Carlton's hand, and I think Richard wants to talk. So, Carlton.
I just wanted to say, to address your concern as well, I think that you could probably put in the code that, or in the proceeding hearing, like the procedures that like people who are on the hearing boards actually like look over and look and see in the guidance relevant information. You know, so at least like it is brought up and like conversed in this space without like making it complete law, but you know it's going to be referenced.
I have virtual experience with this, but it seems like Casey has to run. I don't agree with this too. Mm-hmm. I noticed a small mistake in our minutes, which I want to bring to the like, attention. The minutes I sent out this evening or last morning there was a couple tweaks I made in them in terms of typo fixes and the like. It's the ones that were sent out via email are not the ones you see in front of you. So I just wanted to note that. It's not a major instance, it's sort of typographic errors on my comments or errors that I had caught and changed before they were circulated to members. The versions that were printed were the versions that were sent directly to me by the office and hadn't gone through the tweaks yet. Traditionally what we do is I tweak them, they go into members, we approve them. For some reason the wrong version got printed, so I just wanted to be aware of that. So I'm gonna do them. We're going to incorporate Michelle's amendments into the version that I had edited, and then and you circulate the email, and then put those on the website. Just want to make sure there's no concerns with that. So.
I motion to extend the meeting by half hour.
Absolutely. Makes sense. If we're done early, we'll adjourn.
Fantastic.
I was wondering if everyone was aware that that's what we're going to do, and sure there's no dissent to doing that. I just noticed that as Greece started talking, and you know, hopefully one, I'm sure we're all on the same page. Okay, we're good. Thank you so much, Casey. This is very good. Thank you so much for your services here. We hope you should have to stick around another year to be reappointed. So, I can talk. I can tell that you can say handle if you want to reapply. And Rena would be here, but she's traveling. So, we'll talk. But congratulations. Good luck on your dance.
Thanks. Good luck.
Okay. So, Richard, you're on the speakers list.
So, Risa, that was a very articulate and elegant description of guidelines. I really like that. I think at the end of the revision of the code, the thorough revision, you should have no guidelines. They should either be in the code or they should be gone. And it should be this harvesting that Matt was talking about. They've been around for 5 years and, you know, they're not important enough or significant or well-worded enough to put in the code, then we should dump them. You know, we can have guidelines in the future, you know, after the code has been adopted. This is a time for really deciding what is in and what is out.
I think Matt, you mentioned this, that one of the things that this that CJC can discuss is whether to have a reference in the code to guidances, right? To say, and that those guidances may change over time more easily than actually changing the code. It isn't that they're not enforceable, but that they reflect the kinds of considerations that hearing boards will consider, as well as educating the public about, for example, the use of a totality of the circumstances approach to defining harassment. That doesn't have to be listed in the definition of harassment in the code, but it's part of the evidentiary base for how you decide when you've got harassment. Like you consider the frequency of events, how serious they are, even a single incident that's serious enough can be harassment. Does it involve, you know, one or more groups? You know, how pervasive is it? Well, that's in the code. But there is lots of discussion that's been developed by the EOC and by OCR that they have in guidances that are accepted as, you know, like OCR, this is what they're going to follow, but they put it in guidances and they adopt them through a public comment period. So rather than saying, well, let's put all of that material into the provision about hostile environment harassment, there could be a reference to a guidance to say for additional explanation criteria that hearing boards will consider in determining whether this harassment see this guidance.
So here's the code, mm-hmm. and we come to harassment. Mm-hmm. And then there's a footnote that says, go to Appendix A for guidances.
Yeah, that give examples and explain the criteria that would be used in determining whether something is severe or pervasive.
Now, the question I pose, this may be more appropriate for next fall, but is, can Appendix A be changed without changing the code?
Well, if the CJC wanted to change it, I guess the CJC could change it. I mean, it's basically incorporated into the code by reference.
Right, but it wouldn't have to go to the president.
That would be a much larger discussion.
Yeah, that's a discussion. I think this warrants a further study of just what guidance would mean and is it that I can do it.
Absolutely. And I should say the task force has brought up, I mean, it's something we've been kicking around this past year in terms of how to manageably address certain shortcomings in the code that's later in our agenda. But it's a large discussion. It's one we're going to have. I personally look forward to having. I'm sure Dale and I told Dale we're going to have a long conversation about how we want to do this as we work together. Can be on track next year, and as members come and go, we'll see where it goes. But I think I really just want to commend Greece on the working group for the truly excellent work, put a lot of time and effort. Really quick. Final comments, hearing none, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the leadership on this. I personally really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure working on this and the committee in general.
And Matt was amazing.
Thank you. You're very kind. I look forward to seeing you next year.
Thank you.
Should I resist the cooking though?
Yeah, no, they're absolutely
really
good.
You deserve
to. I have to drive. I have to drive. I need a cookie to drive.
You have some coffee. We have to.
Thank you.
So we just lost four. It's not a big deal. We improved the minutes, aside from the small pickup, which we'll switch. That brings us to our last couple of items. I'm going to run through them in relatively quick order. I'll pause your questions throughout. So we have no concerns. In terms of the hearing room staffing, we received the decoder key last week. I have begun the process of reaching out. Recently, the OBCC did move forward on that. People are in exams now, especially law students who applied, which makes it very difficult to get back to us, so they're saying wait. Joel City was kind enough to get back to me today with the list of members who want to renew. I briefed the UA yesterday because of the delay. A, the UA passed Appendix A as its procedures to ensure that this situation doesn't happen again, considering that lots of it happened close to 4 years ago, different matters. What we're going to do, as briefly, I think many were on the same page, is members who wish to continue serving on the hearing boards are going to be publicly circulated once we verify they want to arrest them. They will be publicly circulated via the info listserv and other public venues. If we don't hear anything negative, and actually we'll circulate it to the JIACC, hearing boards, et cetera. Assuming we hear anything negative, they will be given emergency appointments that will carry them through the fall, so they will continue. We are in the process of, once we figure out, we have our internal rankings. Unfortunately, a bunch of hearing board members reapplied. They are turned out, they're the highest ranked candidates we had, which I guess is a good thing. But in essence, once they filter those out and go through and figure out who we'd like to continue, I'll circulate those names in essence, those people internally to the committee, and they also receive emergency appointments. And in the fall, UA is the one who will be giving them full confirmation. Again, the hope is with UA, the Appendix A, is to ensure this never, ever happens again, because in essence, it starts the process in February, goes to wait until April. Again, it's a delay, we won't run out of time. That's where we are. It's not great. I'll freely admit that. We are taking steps to ameliorate it, as well as we have the appendix, as well as steps with the administration in terms of some of the hiccups we have with required information. I have Michelle on the speaker list.
Yeah, I just had a question. I thought there was some members of the committee had already framed. I thought their names were going to be submitted to the
community. Yes, but those meant that people who did the best were the ones who were already on for renewal. So we've done, and because we didn't have, in essence, we would have had to submit them and vote on the same meeting, so that wouldn't have worked procedurally. So procedurally, it was just a matter of it was going to happen.
There's a possibility that we have 7 hearings this summer.
Yes.
So I
think. Yes, so you will get everyone. We're very cognizant of that. Our goal is to, A, reappointments should be done without a problem. If there be a version of the ballot appointments, that also actually puts in the reapplication portion. And then also the new members who are willing to serve. I think they can train, but they will be. Our hope is to have this done hopefully in the next couple of weeks. It's just a matter of not people on exams, but our goal is to be done before term expire. May 31.
Yeah, and then my second question is, who's the one who's reached out to Charlie? And
so,
the president for.
Yes, so we're looking for Charlie, and actually the president, that'd be me and Gabe. For Charlie, I needed to get with Joel's, in terms of the fact that you want to re-up, I now have a better picture, so I'll be reaching out to Charlie in the next day or so. I can't do it since say Charlie made X applicants. Let us know who you're nominating, we'll do a quick vet, and they'll get emergency appointments as well, and to ensure that we are at full function. In terms of a practical matter, I expect the fact that people likely get full strength this summer. Again, it's just a matter of once we can verify people want to renew. And we'll get to book it to everyone we can. And we have an emergency contingency if we really fall short. But we are very cognizant that we need to get boards that are constituted for the fact that we top priority this summer.
Okay.
Of course. Anything else? Any other questions? Fantastic.
President as well as the chairs.
Yes.
Chair.
Yes. So I will actually make a personal note. I'm actually doing the president this morning, so I will. Sure.
I've got a chair retiring.
Yes.
And one chair wants to be renewed.
Yes.
That was the latest.
Mm-hmm. And also from a practical standpoint, and down on our transition meeting, but assuming our intent to increase the size of the board goes through what we do in a special solicitation in the fall to facilitate newly created seats. And that would hopefully also ameliorate the fact that if for some reason something else were to slip again, we're not going to the point where we don't have boards that are so completely we can't do what we the board's kept with their jobs. Next up is discussion of, revision of the code. It's still ongoing. I'll talk to Dale. In essence, the guidance document, I think, is a much larger discussion in terms of the reorganization and how it all fits together. That will, at this point, it's going to become intrinsic with the report from the working group. The way I personally see it unfolding, then the new committee will be free and will may deviate would be next year. The ones that come through quickly are amending the preamble, adding the harassment language really quickly. Then in terms of the larger examination, which fits personally in my position very neatly into the idea of a reorganization guidance document to try and remove superfluous or duplicative language, while in essence still ensuring that we're balanced and still being the procedures that we like in the code and procedural protections are still maintained. That's going to be a larger discussion. So that would fit there. In terms of the attachments to the packet, as there was some confusion that was brought to my members about the retention policies for various warnings and the like. Michelle was kind enough to provide me her internal writer retention policy, as well as I included an excerpt from 2 pages of policy 4.7 for how long records are maintained. And just to ensure that it's clear on that, I know there was, I personally was a little bit, heard some contrary information or practice and interpreted how long written warnings with second-hand records, and I think this does provide clarity. So I wanted to ensure with you as members, if there are any questions or not. Hearing none, fantastic. That brings us to updates to the previous passing amounts of the campus code. The JA appointment language was approved by this committee last week. It was passed by the UA yesterday with a couple of modifications made by the UA, as well as talking with the administration. And this is all the amendments, since items from this committee were incorporated, and then the administration and the executive committee had discussed back and forth to address it. It was passed. The president, this person, has already indicated she's at least informed and supported it, so we expect that will be going forward. Personally, I think it's a really excellent outcome we'll be able to do in a month, which I think is a good, really good, an excellent job illustrating that when chair governance and the administration want to work together, and we're motivated to work together, we do so quite well. Additionally, the other 10 or so code amendments were we placed a daily sun ad, we held public office hours, we presented other assemblies, we posted public comment. And the UA yesterday preliminary approved them, but actually decided to hold off on formally voting them until Friday to ensure that some ads were running up until yesterday, assuming someone saw them today or was late to provide comment. They will be, since they're on track to be approved. There's one small change that might occur to one of them, actually there's two, one. The death and suspension, per President Pollack's recommendation, in essence, wearing a footnote saying they've been removed, she asked for a date to be added. The UA fully accepted that was put in. And the for one of the solicitations for University Hearing Review Board applicants, we had made a change to that in terms of how the UA interacts with office assemblies. The assembly, we're considering withdrawing that item appendix today because we think that will do the same job. And so, in essence, that language might tweak a little bit, but otherwise, I think it's moving forward. Formally adopted at the end of this week or early next. Michelle, I think you got it.
I didn't see the code revisions in resolution form.
Yes, so this was a logistical hiccup. They are broken out as requested by the committee and are being, in essence, the key was to ensure that the actual amendments have been very, very heavily circulated. The actual resolution breakouts didn't get tacked on, they'll be sent out totally today or tomorrow. They are just aware as clauses that describe the process that we went through them. The actual operative language has been very heavily brought up.
That's just one of those things that I know that we have talked about that coming out of the committee. So in the future, if you could help through that, I know we're happy to break that. But I think sometimes when we look at the whereas, people, when that's actually binding, sometimes the resolve statements, sometimes the whereas, like that's important language to make sure that we're all on the same page. But I would just add the same way. I know that the UA passed resolution number 3 with thanks to the chair and things like that. I think that was something that we had talked about as a committee wanted to do to make sure. And so just as you guys do your transition, maybe putting that on the calendar that it'll come March, that a resolution similar to resolution 23, in which this committee thinks that people who participate in the process should probably be seen by this committee.
Yeah,
similar.
It's actually very helpful. So there we are. That brings us to the final remark, which is closing remarks. Actually, the UA yesterday passed a formal resolution and told Casey to thank everyone who was on the committees. We had a resolution to thank everyone in the everyone on the hearing boards, everyone in the JA's office, everyone in the JCP's office, everyone in the working group. And I don't believe we forgot anyone. Only thank our clerks. Thank you, Margaret, very much. It's been a pleasure to work with you this year. And so that passed all through. The thanks really was quite honestly names in. Thank you for X, Y. Generally, specifically noted, otherwise not. There was, it's based off the general way of template. There was a general one for the whole assembly. I wrote one for the usual system because our committee.
Did you thank Gina?
Gina was thanked in the university one, the full assembly.
Oh, okay.
Yes. She was thanked. Okay. We verified that. So she was listed, but those ones are formally, so they'll be fully circulated through X. I just wanted to thank the whole committee, though. It's been a really sort of great year. It's been a very busy year. We've met on average, I believe, coming up on 30 times, which is a very large amount. It's more than the past 5 or 6 years combined. I think we had a very productive year, and I look forward to continuing next year in slightly different capacity. I'm sure Dale is sort of taking over his chair. It's really been an excellent experience. I will say I'm looking forward to not having to write agendas and send them out. It'll be hours of Wednesday morning. And also, I will be compiling a brief annual report to the assembly as required by our bylaws. We're actually late because it's May 1, but traditionally we're going to be done a little afterwards. I'll be doing anything to include when it's done, it'll be circulated. I'm actually talking to church, there's talking to people, do it. Either way, assuming it's done, it'll be circulated to the committee. It'll be relatively similar to what we're doing. And that is to go up all I have. I think I have a show of hand and.
I know that you probably talked about this before, but I know one of the chefs gets a lot more.
Yes.
Okay. I'm sure it's on your list, but.
Yes, that is unfortunate. Weekly meetings are taxing. My understanding is next year we might go back to bi-weekly, but we'll see. Put up the new committee and the new chair. But weekly meetings can be onerous for everyone in terms of your scheduling, in terms of trying to find a free slot.
This is just, we get a lot done in the last half of the meeting. Like if we met bi-weekly, but twice as long, I actually think that'd be a better idea. So a suggestion, I think it would work better. I don't think if we do it bi-weekly, we're not going to, I don't even know if I can remember that. Committees, it's up to you folks. But my own feeling is you meet bi-weekly and not have a vice code.
Well, that's also part of it because we went to weekly this year.
Yeah.
And then we had a lot of things come up.
Yeah. So that would be a suggestion. Suggestion.
No, I agree. And personally, I hope you are still on the committee. I really enjoyed working with you. Thank you for here, which is quite helpful for form.
I guess it's part of the other too, but do you have the right to remove the members if you don't like them?
Yes, you do. Okay. It's a bit of an Roberts rules gives everyone the committee has itself the Roberts rules. There you might be able to include through our charter or bylaws, and you can also go directly to the executive committee. Historically we haven't done that because a lot of the people there's a lot of reasons we'll talk about why we didn't do that stuff, but there is, we do have that authority, and it becomes an habitual problem, it will certainly be addressed. This year, we'll be able to work around it. If it comes to the point where we're really dealing out of brass tacks, we're going to have people coming, we're going to have to reevaluate. But actually, Dale, me and you will have that conversation.
Yes.
I'll be chair of the assembly, so we'll have that conversation in extreme detail if it happens. But anything really is going to say, truly thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. I know the weekly meetings are a lot, and it's been a lot to work with you all. So thank you very much. I could talk forever. I know I can. This year has been a lot of me talking, perhaps too much. So I'm just going to say thank you one more time, and that's it.
Thank you.
So assuming there's nothing else to add to our agenda, that would mean we're adjourned. So the time is 6 o'clock. Thank you very much. Everyone have a safe summer.